Well, good morning, everybody. If you're like me this week, your news feeds were filled with talks of earthquakes. So the first, the first major one was the first one. There was a massive earthquake in Taiwan, registering at 7.4 in magnitude, largest earthquake they've had in roughly 25 years. The images of the devastation were significant. I mean, it was really a nightmare. And then on top of that, on Friday morning, if you were looking at things, there was an earthquake in New Jersey, came in at 4.8 in magnitude. And then after that, maybe you don't know, but in Northern California, there was two also on Thursday. In Plumas County, there was a 4.4 earthquake, and then 23 seconds later, another one hit, a 4.2. Right after each other. Now, because it was in Plumas County, it wasn't a densely populated area, we really didn't hear about those. But as I was looking through things, it made the news on multiple sites and outlets. And then, while I was reviewing for this sermon yesterday, roughly 5:30 p.m., there was another earthquake. You know, just when you're like, you're studying about earthquakes, looking at them, and you're like, earthquakes are on your mind, man, I hope we don't have any earthquakes. And then just a little 2.2 centered in Gilroy, California. Just enough to remind you. Did any of you feel it? Okay, so within first service, like three people felt it. It's because if you're in the Bay Area, 2.2 doesn't even register on your scale. That's not an earthquake. That's not a quake. This is the ground burp type of thing. Now, the interesting things about earthquakes is, though, that whenever you experience them, even when they're small, usually your mind goes back to previous earthquakes that you experienced, and you remind yourself of, like, what they could do. This is just a 2.2, no big deal, but, man, we've had some big ones. And if you are of the age and grew up in the area, then when you think about earthquakes that you remember, there is one in particular that always stands out, right? 5:04 p.m., Tuesday, October 17th, 1989, Loma Prieta earthquake. Huge. Most of you, if you were here, could remember where you were, right? Like, if you were here, you remember when it went down. This one was 6.9 in magnitude. It reached, the shakes reached all the way to San Diego and as far east as the western border of Nevada and California. It shook for 20 seconds. There were 63 deaths and thousands of injuries. I was 6 years old at that time, and I remember someone laughed. That might be the greatest insult, depending, like, because it could be nice, like, oh, you're younger than I thought, or it could, you're way younger than I. You might have thought I was talking about the San Francisco earthquake of like 1911 or whatever. So I was six, and I remember it, and it changed our culture overnight. Do you remember, like, every discussion after that was about the earthquake? When you see someone that you didn't see, even if it didn't start like this, it's only a matter of time before you're like, so what happened? Where were you? And you'd tell stories about where you were, what happened, if it was scary or not, and everyone was talking about aftershocks and still tremors that could occur, which for a six-year-old is kind of scary. Because you really don't know how to process that, because it went something like this. You just experienced some horrible earthquake. Everything was shaking. You're like, well, we have to watch out for aftershocks. Six-year-old. So when are these aftershocks coming? We don't know. How big are they going to be? We don't know. We don't know how big they are. We don't know how many there are. But we know they're coming because they always come. You're like, what? Well, what are you supposed to do? Well, if you're at school, son, hide under your desk. Because the structures of whatever building you are in are likely to come crashing down. And so hopefully the desk, you'll be fine. Go get him, Tiger. Like, what? So it has that way of sort of reminding us of those scary components. But there's an additional thing about earthquakes that are scary. So there's obviously at the surface level, like, they're scary because the ground shakes and there is this shaking of the foundations that we have on. But what makes them even more scary is that what occurs in an earthquake at one level of reality is actually what can occur and is always occurring at nearly every layer of reality. Because earthquakes remind you that even the ground you stand on is not a secure foundation. There is, even the ground you place your feet upon is not secure, certain, or stable. If the ground you walk on can shake, then anything could shake. And what earthquakes do is you see buildings collapse, you see the ground shake, and it's this constant reminder, nothing is certain, nothing is secure, nothing is stable. And at any given moment, it can all come down. So it is true at the level of an earthquake, at that level of reality, is also true of nearly every layer of reality, every layer of your life. You know, nothing is certain, nothing is secure. There can be a car accident tomorrow. You can get a bad diagnosis at the doctor. You can lose a job. War may break out. Economics collapse might happen. And as the world kind of appears to be crazier and crazier, you get this sense of like, yeah, nothing seems secure and stable. And so earthquakes are terrifying in that they are a physical embodiment at one layer of reality that manifests this truth that is true at every level, nearly every level. Like, nothing's secure. Even the ground you walk on. In AD 17, there was a massive earthquake in the region of Asia Minor. The city that was most devastated by it was a city called Philadelphia, and I don't think our Philadelphia in the United States. We're in Asia Minor, roughly 2,000 years ago, AD 17. And this earthquake just completely destroyed the city so much that subsequent to it, the entire culture, the people, is forever changed, down to the way they plan buildings and houses and how you organize the city. It's forever changed. This earthquake was so massive that we still have references in the ancient documentation. So, for example, we have references to people saying, this earthquake of AD 17 in that region was the greatest quake in human memory. So, when you went and talked with your dad or your grandpa or your great-grandpa, no one's remembering anything like this one that hit in AD 17 in the region of Asia Minor. Also, it was said of Philadelphia that the destruction was so bad that people then lived outside of the city. Now, that may not sound like a big deal to you because you think, oh, like we can go out and live in the country. Awesome. No, safety was found within the city walls. In the ancient world, security and safety was within the city walls. If there's an invading enemy, you're in the city walls, you have protection. So to live outside of the city walls is an extremely vulnerable place. And we know that the people of Philadelphia then moved outside. It was so bad that the current Caesar of the day said that the people of Philadelphia did not have to pay tax or tribute for 5 years in order to rebuild. Now, sometimes when we're talking history, you could just go, oh, there's another interesting historical piece. No, no, stop. Now picture it. Picture it for you. Caesar, the government, the Roman Empire says no taxes for 5 years? Let that sink in. It'll never happen to you. You'll never know what that feels like. This is only an exercise in imagination. So for 5 years, that occurs. Additionally, we know from the sources that the city, all of its buildings just had cracks in them. The pillars had either fallen down, and even when they did rebuilding, just the aftershocks and tremors made everything have cracks in it. Pavement, pillars, structures, everything was just reminders of the earthquakes. And then you forever live in the uncertainty of another one's coming. Now, it's to that church in the city of Philadelphia that Christ writes one of the letters to the seven churches. If you've been with us since the beginning of this series, we're in the book of Revelation, the first part of it, looking at seven churches in the region of Asia Minor near the end of the first century who receive words from Jesus. The seven cities are Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, and we are in Philadelphia today, and then next week we'll be Laodicea. So for a people who live on the outside, who live with the threat of another earthquake, who have seen destruction, who have seen the walls of their shelters come tumbling down, the words of our Lord. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. Now, again, if you've been tracking with this, usually when Jesus addresses one of these churches in these regions, he identifies himself with images. And sometimes these images are really easy to decipher. Sometimes they're more difficult. But usually they have some relationship with the current cultural context of the city. So in this case, Jesus says he's the Holy One, he's the true one, and he's the one who has the key of David. Now, the first one's pretty straightforward. Jesus is the Holy One. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, many things are referred to as holy. But specifically, the Holy One, or the Holy One of Israel, is a title usually referring to God himself. And so Jesus takes up that divine mantle. He takes up that authority and says, I am the Holy One and the true one. Now, we can't be certain, but with the true one, there might be another kind of historical situation that resonates with why Jesus might identify himself as the true one. So, as we mentioned, after this great earthquake in that region, there was relief for 5 years from taxes. So the people of Philadelphia loved Caesar. Like, Caesar's awesome. He loves us. He's not taxing us. He cares for us. He wants us to rebuild. Decades after that, and another Caesar comes along, and there's an order that takes place throughout the region of Asia Minor. And the order says that all fields that are being used for grape production have to be cut in half. So 50% of all the soil, all the ground that's growing grapevines has to be brought down. Now, why would he do that? Likely, Caesar and the Roman Empire was trying to encourage the production of cereal grains. Think like wheat and barley, things like that. They said, we have enough, this is like, we got totally enough grapes, totally enough vines, we need to start encouraging other things, and so what we're going to do is we're just going to make it a law. 50% of grape production gets cut and replaced with something else. Now, for most cities, that's a problem, but it's overcomable. It's like the farm, you go out, your farmer, like, man, we got to chop down all this and replant, it's going to cost us some stuff, but you can make the adjustments and still keep going. However, for the region of Philadelphia, their soil was volcanic soil, and it was a special type of soil that was particularly suited for vines, for growing grapes. So they couldn't just go, okay, we're going to start growing barley here. They couldn't do it. The soil wouldn't do it. And so this was an absolute kind of economic devastation that would occur upon a people in Philadelphia who are already experiencing all kinds of problems, who already are the poorest city, one of the poorest cities in the region. So what happened was there was this great feeling of betrayal and disillusionment at the hand of Caesar. He went from being the true one, the faithful one, to being the betrayer. How could you do this to us? And that disillusionment affected the people. And so it's quite possible that Christ is reminding them that, yes, in your context, there is someone who claims to be Kurios in Greek, Lord, and he has betrayed you. Nevertheless, I am the true Lord, the true Kurios, and I will be true and faithful. So there might be a contrasting of the hands of Caesar and the hands of the Lord. And then the next one is a little bit more difficult. Who has the key of David? Who opens and no one will shut? Who shuts and no one opens? So what is the key of David? There are two other references that are important for understanding Christ's claim to have a key. Some of you might remember week one of this series, we talked about how Christ claims to be the one who has the keys of death and Hades. So we already have this talk of him holding the keys, but now we're introduced to another concept of Christ having the keys to the house of David, or the key of David, and something to do with the ability to open and to close. And to this, you have to turn to the Old Testament, like much of the book of Revelation, Isaiah 22, and you'll see this is an actual direct quote to something. So what was occurring in Isaiah 22? God was telling a steward who had been corrupted, he was a steward over the house of David, look, you're corrupt, and I'm going to take away your key, and I will give it to my servant named Eliakim. And then he will have the authority of the key over the house of David. But listen to Isaiah 22:22 to see how it's worded. I will place on his shoulder, Eliakim, the key of the house of David. He shall open, and none shall shut. He shall shut, and none shall open. Does this sound familiar? It's like almost a direct quote. Well, what does it mean to have this key? Okay, the key is can be obviously something literal, but the metaphoric meaning is much more important. The one who holds the key is given authority over the house of David. They might actually be like second in charge to the king. So God is removing it from this corrupt individual and giving it to Eliakim. Then Eliakim will have the authority to decide who gets into Jerusalem, who gets into the city of David, who gets into the house of David. So it determines who's in and who's out. If you want to go into the king's house, the one who holds the key is the one who gives you permission. If he opens the door, you can come in. If he closes the door, you can't come in. So the key has to do with who's in and who's out and who gets access to the king's presence. Now, there's another reference, the second part, which we looked at week one. John sees and beholds Jesus at the introduction of the book of Revelation, and he says this, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid at his right hand on me, saying, 'Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades.'" Now, if you were here for week one, we got into this. But suffice to say for now, remember, Jesus saying, "I have the key to death itself." And the way that works is because Jesus actually goes into death. And normally, for all human beings, death is like the prison cell that you cannot escape from. No one goes into the prison of death and comes out. Christ's claim is that he goes into the prison itself, breaks the bars of that prison, takes the keys, and come back to life, and now has the authority to open and close the path of death. Now, those two verses might not seem like they have anything in common. Like, what does the key of the house of David have to do with the keys of death and Hades? But when you take a step back, you can see what's going on. Christ's claim is that he's the one with the authority of life and death, and he's the one who decides who's in and who's out. Who's in the kingdom, who's in the house, who's in the presence of God, and who's not. So they're actually related once you kind of take a step back and think at them at a much deeper level. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, "The words of the Holy One, the true one, who has the key of David, who opens, no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens." Now, why is it critically important that the Christians in Philadelphia know that Christ is the one with the key into the presence of God, into the city of God, into the house of God? Why is that critical? It tells us what's next. "I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name." Verse 9, "Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you." It's a heavy verse, right? Synagogues of Satan and people being brought forth to bow down at the feet of the Christians in Philadelphia, and then they will know that Christ loves them. It's very heavy. Okay, so there's something going on that's central to understanding what's going on in this text. So the first thing you have to understand is that the first Christians did not think they were converting to a new religion. Why? Well, let's go back to who the very first Christians were. Who were the first Christians? They were Jews who came to Jerusalem at a time of a holy day. And during this holy day, Peter gives a message. The day of Pentecost. And all these Jewish people from all around the region become Christians. Now, when they become a Christian, they are not saying like, "Oh yeah, I converted to becoming a Christian," or "I found a new religion," or "I found something new." What do the first Jewish Christians think is occurring? They believe not that they're changing a religion or going a different way, but that Jesus is now the Messiah that their Hebrew scriptures have been pointing to all along. They're not changing anything. Their claim is that everything I was hearing growing up in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, has all been pointing to our Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, Jesus. And now we are putting our faith in him, not as a contradiction to the old, but as the fulfillment, climax, and zenith of everything we've already believed. So, let's say you're one of the first Christians. You're a Jewish person. You came to Jerusalem to celebrate, and now you believe in Jesus. After the holy day, the holiday, you go back to all the places that you travel. And where do Jewish people go to experience the community of faith? In Jerusalem, there's a temple, but that's the only location. All the other locations, there's synagogues. So now all of a sudden, all throughout the Roman Empire in that region, you were having Jewish believers go into synagogues, but now they believe Jesus is the fulfillment of the faith. Now, at first, that might be all good and fine, but it's only a matter of time you can predict that's like, well, what about all the people who don't believe Jesus is the Messiah in the synagogue? How do they all get along in the context of the synagogue where some of them are saying Jesus is the Messiah and some are saying, no, he's not? And let's amplify this, because the first Christians aren't saying like, Jesus is Messiah, and he's like, it's not that big of a deal if you don't believe in him. What are they saying? They're saying Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. We don't get to the Father except but through him. So Christ is central to the first Christian's claim. He's a Messiah figure, yes, but he's the Son of God and the way to salvation. But then on the other side, you might have people who, some people maybe just go, I don't think Jesus is the Messiah. He was a good man. He was a prophet, maybe. But then you probably have some people who are going, this guy was a lunatic. This guy was a false teacher. You messianic Jewish believers in Jesus, you guys are, you're not one of us. You believe something radical and different. And so we don't know how long it took, but very early on in church history, a split happens within the Jewish community. Keep in mind, this is an intra-Jewish debate. These are Jewish Christians, Jewish Messiah-believing Christians, and then Jews who aren't believing the Messiah. And eventually what occurs is the Jews who are believing Jesus as Messiah, they get kicked out of the synagogue. And the idea is like, you guys aren't one of us. You believe this other stuff. So imagine this. Your community of faith, your friends and your family, you get rejected from that for your faith in Jesus, and you get kicked out. You are outside of the household and the people of the faith community you knew and loved. Additionally, it gets worse. Because oftentimes in the region of Asia Minor, the emperor, Caesar, would have things that the citizens would have to do. Like maybe you have to pay special tribute to Caesar, and maybe you burn a little incense before an altar, and you declare Caesar to be a god on earth. Now, Rome knew that there was a people group, namely the Jewish people, who would be like, we're not going to bow to Caesar. And after a lot of fighting, at some points in history, the Roman Empire said, okay, we're going to give the Jewish people an exemption from having to do this Caesar worship stuff. Now put the pieces together. If you are a Messiah-believing person, you're a Christian, and you get kicked out of the synagogue for your faith in Jesus, now how does Rome look at you? Do you have the exemption that you once had now that you're kicked out? And furthermore, there might be people in the synagogue system saying, they're not one of us. And so not only do you get kicked out of the community of faith for your faith in Jesus, but now you're open to severe persecution. Come down and offer a sacrifice to Zeus or to Caesar, or go to prison, or face torture, or face death. And so you're kicked out. You're an outcast. You're rejected. You're on the outside because you put your faith in Jesus. And then it ends with this weird thing. It says, behold, I will make them come down and bow before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. And as a Christian, your kind of immediate response to that is, that doesn't sound right. Like, no one's supposed to bow before human beings. We only bow before God. So why is Christ saying he's going to make the people who rejected those people come bow at their feet? Well, this again is a quote from the Old Testament. The book of Isaiah, the sons of those who afflicted you shall come bending low to you. So this is a different time, but a similar situation. Israel is rejected. They are cast out. They are being oppressed by the nations. But God reminds Israel, hey, look, even though you're presently afflicted, know that one day the sons of those who afflicted you shall come bending low to you, and all who despised you shall bow down at your feet. They shall call you the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. There's that Holy One phrase again. And so what God was telling Israel in the book of Isaiah is, even though the whole world rejects you and you're mistreated, there's a day when they will come bow before you. Now, don't think like they're coming to worship people in Israel in Isaiah's day. Don't think that. This is basically saying they are going to recognize that you truly are the people of God, and they will respect and give tribute to you. So in other words, God will vindicate you among the nations. Now, that same thing that was happening in Isaiah's day is now being quoted and applied to these Christians in Philadelphia who have been rejected and cast out and now face deep persecution. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Now you can see why it was central to the early Christian message that there is now neither Jew nor Gentile, male, female, slave, free in Christ Jesus. That we are brought into the people of God, not conditioned on anything but grace received through faith. And so that's why that's a central theological claim. And then he says to the people who have been rejected, because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world, to those who dwell on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. Now, whenever we hear a phrase like, there's a great trial coming upon the whole world, especially when you're in the book of Revelation, you go, when's that going to happen so I could get ready? And Revelation has a lot to say about the future, especially in the latter portions of the book, a lot to say about the future. But remember where we are at. We're in the first few chapters, and the first few chapters of Revelation are letters that are written to seven cities, seven churches in the region of Asia Minor towards the end of the first century. And so there is some type of dynamic. Something's going to happen in the Roman Empire where an intense time of trial is going to come. And God is saying, when this comes to you, you will be protected. But this is important. Did God say he would protect any of the other churches in this series from persecution or harm? The answer is no. In fact, in the previous weeks, God's like, get ready. You're about to be thrown into prison. You're about to face suffering and persecution. We don't know exactly the reason why, but this intense period is about to occur, and God tells the Christians in Philadelphia that they'll be spared from at least some of the implications, ramifications of it. But the other churches, he basically says, get ready, which is an important principle for every single one of us today. Because this is always the case. Right now, presently, as we sit here in this church, there are Christians who are in prison. There are Christians who are being tortured for their faith. There are Christians who are facing death because they believe in Jesus. They've experienced rejection at every level of their family, their culture, their people, their governments for the name of Christ. And they suffer immensely. They're going through the hour of trial. Meanwhile, simultaneously, there's people who have it pretty good. Simultaneously, while someone is in prison facing death, there's us sitting in a church with cushioned chairs. And if it gets too hot in here, we can cool it down. And if it gets too cool, we can turn on a heater so that we're all comfortable this Sunday morning. So this principle is always true. The body of Christ sometimes is suffering here and in another area not. And we are called to be faithful in the good and the bad. And if the sovereign Lord decides to bring some of his people and some of his body into persecution for the sake of the gospel and the glory of the Father, then we submit to that. And also, if the Lord is gracious and he brings us into a time of ease, we are to still praise him and be thankful, ever ready for hard times. And so you can never, ever forget that, because if you do, complacency, mediocrity, what the scriptures called like lukewarm faith just kind of kicks in. It's just easy, no big deal, and you can go with it. He concludes the letter, "The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Now, in that ending, there is a putting together of all the various images and historical pieces that we've been discussing. It's kind of hard to see at first, but it's there. So first, he says, even though you've been rejected, even though you're on the outside, even though you're an outcast, you literally live outside of the city walls. I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. Now, in the Old Testament, where's the presence of God located? I mean, he's omnipresent, God is everywhere, but he specifically manifests his presence in the temple. So if you are by the temple or near the temple, you are near to God. What is he telling these Christians, these faithful followers who have been rejected and kicked out, who are told they are not the true people of God? I will make you a pillar. Now, some of these people probably grew up hearing stories about the glory of the temple in Jerusalem, how beautiful the structure was, the pillars, the stone, and they could not imagine something that glorious. And now them, little old you, will be a pillar in the temple of God. You will be near to him. You will be close to him. You will not be cast out. Pillars don't move, right? Their structure is stable. Well, for these people, they might go, not always. Pillars aren't stable because we have lots of earthquakes. The stone pillars of Philadelphia crack and fall. But what God is saying is, I am building a temple made not of stone and pillars, but of people. The household of God is not built with earthly walls. It's built with people. The temple of God is the people of God, and the Spirit of God indwells his people. And then listen to the next line, and now it makes sense. Never shall he go out of it. Because when you're reading it, that's just really easy to skip over. Now, never go out of it. Okay, I got it. No. Never shall you be cast out. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem. These images are still harmonizing. So why is there this talk about the new Jerusalem? Remember, Jesus has the key to the house of David. There's a literal Jerusalem, and there's a literal house of David. And Eliakim could let people into that or not let people into that. And so that the house of the key of David is who gets in and who gets out. But now Christ speaks not just merely of an earthly Jerusalem, but the new Jerusalem from heaven coming down. And he says, of this new Jerusalem that is coming down, I have the keys to it. I will make you a pillar. I will write on you the name of my God. Yes, you're rejected and you've been told you don't worship the true God. You are not of the people of God. You have on your very being the name of the Holy One, the Righteous One, the true God. You will be a pillar in the presence of God. You will never be kicked out. You will experience the new Jerusalem, which comes down from God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So you see the logic of this now. Christ has the keys. Why is that important? Because some people have been kicked out of the house. Why did they get kicked out of the house? Because they believed Jesus is the Messiah. And now they face rejection and scorn and shame and possible persecution for their faith in Jesus. And Jesus is then telling them, yes, in this life, oftentimes there's suffering and hardship. Nevertheless, hold fast. Do not let go. Keep your eyes on the cross of Christ. Conquer and endure, because there's something waiting for you. Now, this issue of belonging is incredibly important for a number of reasons. Oftentimes, it's very difficult to feel like you belong somewhere. And there's multiple reasons for that. Some of it's just just culture and technology. Like, the modern world is a lonely age. We know this statistically. The numbers about how many people are wrestling with loneliness are through the roof. Many of you know you experience immense loneliness. So I know the stats are clear. Many of you in the room would say that you're lonely. And for some of you, it's because literally you don't have a lot of relationships. You actually, it's like you have good reason to feel lonely. I don't have enough friends and relationships. And then for some people, you have tons of relationships, tons of friends. Nevertheless, you still feel lonely. It's like a plague upon our people in the modern world. Like, loneliness just sets in at every level. And then there's also this deep thing that's difficult of, like, I don't feel like I belong anywhere. There's 1,000 reasons why you might feel that way too. Some of you may go back, like, early on to childhood. Like, you've always sort of been on the out, never a part of the in. You're outside of the city walls, kind of rejected and outcast. Some of you, you're like, even as I'm talking, you have memories going back to, like, second grade. You know, second grade, you goes out for recess, and there's some kids playing basketball, and you get the courage to ask, can I play? And you hear, game's locked. Some of you know what that means. Game's locked. And you go, and you try to, maybe you tried to convince yourself that basketball is a 5-on-5 game. It looks like there's five on five, maybe there's just too many people. But you go back, you know, the next recess, the next day, and the next recess, and the kids always tell you, game's locked. We don't want to play with you. It's like Forrest Gump on that bus. You're taken, taken, taken. There's no seat for you. There's no seat for you. No one wants you to sit next to them. Maybe you grew up and you were bullied, or maybe you weren't bullied, but you were just kind of on the out. You know, you weren't socially in. Never had a lot of friends, always felt different. Maybe that grew up, you grew up and in adulthood, you weren't good at making friends and you kind of knew you were on the out. Maybe you've been rejected. All kinds of ways you could be rejected. Some of you have been rejected by your parents. Your own parents rejected you. Some of you, your kids have rejected you. Some grandkids have rejected you. And for some of you, your own spouse, the one who you gave everything to, your whole being, you face rejection by them. And so it's very easy for a group of people to feel like an outcast, to feel rejected, that I am of no worth. This is why it's incredibly important for Jesus to tell a people who know rejection that he has the keys. He has the keys. And what he opens, no one can close. And what he shuts, no one can open. So imagine a person, maybe that you can imagine yourself, but imagine a person rejected at every level of their life. They're rejected by their parents. They're rejected by peers and society. They're poverty stricken. They don't have shelter. The rest of the culture deems them as someone who has no value. They have nothing to contribute to anybody, to family, to friends, to culture, to work. They are of no value, poverty stricken, rejected at every level. Now picture the one who holds the keys to the king's house, saying to that one, the doors to Jerusalem are open. The doors into the house of David are open to you. And if you make your way in, you will find a main meeting area, and there's a table set out, and dinner is being prepared. And if you go into that space, you will find that there's a chair pulled out, reserved for you, and it has your name on it, and it will always have your name on it. Because at this king's table, there is always a place for you. Even if the whole world rejects you, what he opens, no one can shut. This is the power of belonging to the one who has the keys of David and death and Hades. Now, why is that so important? Why is it so important that we feel like we belong? Well, because this world is filled with ever-shaking foundations and pillars that come crashing down. This is what earthquakes remind us of, right? There's nothing certain. There's nothing secure. At any given moment, everything could start shaking. And some of you, even as I'm talking about that, you're going, yes, that's true. Stop talking about it, because this whole sermon, I've been thinking about an earthquake happening. And then you create the anxiety thinking on the fact that this is not only true literally of earthquakes, but at every level of our earthly lives. Nothing is certain. Nothing is secure. Bad things happen all the time. And so the psalmist says this as an encouragement in the midst of a world that is constantly shaking. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. In other words, even if the structures of our reality come crumbling down, take heart, because you have an ever-present help, a refuge and strength. Now, there's a way to kind of give a false hope with this. And it looks something like this. Hey, look at this passage. It says, like, even when all these bad things happen, it's all good because you have a present help. God's your refuge. And there's a sense in which that's true, but it's not exactly that, because this passage presupposes that the ground is shaky. The passage presupposes that in life, there are hardships, trials, and tribulations, and there are some things that will feel as if the very structures of reality are crumbling down. So it's not saying it's all good, nothing bad will happen. No, it's saying, like the whole of Scripture, in this world, you will have trouble. Nevertheless, in the midst of a world that is constantly shaking and faulty, and there's no security or safety, even in the places you set your feet, in the midst of that, you do have one unshakable, certain foundation. And in the midst of the ever-shaking, falling down world, you don't cling to earthly, material, temporal realities. You cling to Christ and His kingdom. Earth is temporary, His kingdom, eternity. So you don't cling to things that shake. They'll fail you. They'll falter. And so you cling to the above. It's easier said than done, though. Because this life can hit hard, right? It can hit you real hard. Now, I'd like to illustrate this with a youth group type of sermon. Now, Drew's going to come up here because the other person who is supposed to do this is not in the room. Where is he? Oh, there he comes. You were hiding. I was going to have to make up a joke about you right now. I was going to have to say, it was Kevin, but before service, I locked him out. I shut the door on him. So that as he experienced the illustration, he could feel the full weight of rejection. Nevertheless, he's never let you down. He was sneaky behind the door. Okay, so this is going to be a youth group illustration. This is a youth group illustration that if you grew up in youth group world, like 25 years ago, so I'm just checking to see who's like shaking their head because you'll know it, but it also tells you something else. If you were in youth group 20, 25 years ago, you're like at that place where you start, you know, well, I guess I'm going to my 20-year reunion, 25-year, you know, and then when you hit that, you go, I never thought that would happen. And then there's some of you who are laughing because you're going like, I just went to my 50-year reunion. Well, let me illustrate all of this with an old youth group illustration that goes back to like the days of like Francis Chan and Dan Kimball youth ministry stuff. Okay, some of you might remember this. Okay, there's a big giant rope, and right here there's red tape. Okay, this is classic youth group stuff. But sometimes you need classic youth group stuff to really make the point. Okay, this is where your life began, at the beginning of the red. Okay, see the red? Where the red stops is when you die. Now, hopefully you live very, very long. Like, let's say you live to 97. You're going to live to be 102 years old. So this is the day you were born, and this is 102 when you die. Now, the rest of the rope is your life in eternity. So if you are a Christian, you're born and then you die, and then Christ is saying you will live for eternity with Him. Okay. What the Scriptures are telling you is that in life, in your earthly life, this temporal part of your life, this fading, fleeting portion that's just this big, it will feel often like an eternity. especially with hardship, trial, and tribulation. And it will feel like an earthquake. It will feel like it's shaking. It will feel like you've been through stuff in life, you can't even think of how you got through it. But the scriptures tell us, in the midst of this, you are to hold fast, you keep your eyes on Christ, because however long this feels, however much pain you feel in this little blip, Christ promises you a life everlasting, and you will know joy and glory you cannot fathom in your present moment. And so whatever shaking or disturbances, whatever earthquakes they are, no matter how big they are, cling to Christ. And I don't mean, trust me, because a pastor, you be a pastor for just a few years and you see the hardships that people go through. I know the pain in this room. I know the pain of loss and betrayal, and I know that there are things that you cannot fathom, like how bad that they would feel. And so I am not belittling that pain, but I am telling you, whatever earthly pain you experience, whatever loss you experience, whatever has been done to you in this life, in the big picture of what God has prepared for you, no matter how bad it is but a weakened, it is but a bad weakened compared to the joy and glory Christ has prepared for you. So no matter what's thrown at you, no matter how hard it hits you, cling to the cross, hold fast, keep your eyes on Him, and what seems like an insurmountable amount of pain and suffering will be but a bad weakened because Christ has prepared this for you. And even with this, this doesn't even begin to illustrate the point. Because here's our life, and it's like, okay, there's eternity, but Kevin, you have to go farther. Like, this is you in eternity. This is your earthly life. It's like, keep going, because it still doesn't illustrate it. Do you know what I mean? This is sometimes filled with earthquakes at every layer of reality. But there is a kingdom and a foundation that is unshakable, and you can plant your feet to that. And when you do, Christ is saying, to the one who conquers, I will make you a pillar in the temple of God. This is eternity. Keep going. Keep going. See, there's a door right there. If you could just make your way outside of it and close it a little more. Okay, come back because all the empathetic people won't like me. Okay, thank you, Kevin. Do you see this? Do you see it? The one who conquers, I will give him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from God out of heaven, and my own name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. You need to know that you belong. You belong to the house of God, the people of God. Christ has brought you in. There's a chair with your name on it reserved for you. He has opened the door. And by faith, through grace, you can walk in. And no one's going to take you out. Even if the whole world rejects you, your family rejects you, your people reject you, Christ has a table and a seat with your name on it. For those in Christ, this is your future of belonging. Jesus says in John 14, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be. The language of presence. The king saying, the king. Like, do you understand, like, what business do we have at his table? What business do we have with him? And he says, I'm going to go prepare a place for you so that where I am, you can be too. And he says, verse 4, and you know the way to where I'm going. He says, you know the way I'm going, which is very difficult because the right response to this is, I'm not sure we know the way, Jesus, which is great because there's this guy named Thomas who doubts everything that's there. And he says what we're saying. Thomas said to him, Lord, We don't know where you're going. We don't know. We don't know. How can we know the way? And Jesus says, I am the way, and I am the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. To the angel of the Church of Philadelphia, write the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one will open. Christians presuppose a world filled with suffering and hardship. We don't give ourselves false comfort that it's not going to be difficult. But in this time that we have on earth, we are to hold fast. We never give up. We cling to Him. And whatever we've experienced, whatever you've experienced, whatever you've lost, no matter how overwhelming that is, there will be a day in eternity where it will be but a bad weekend. So endure faithfully. He's worth it. He's always worth it. Let's stand as we take communion.